Thank you for joining us on Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and today with me in studio is Diane Alston. She's the extension entomologist at Utah State University. And if you'd like to join our conversation and talk about little critters, call us at 1-800-826-1495 or go online to upr.org. Click on the Programs tab and you'll see the Access Utah link. So, Diane, thanks for coming in. I have a lot of questions, but I want to dive in and make sure I don't just ask all my questions, unless, of course, nobody calls. But one of the things that you sent to me last week referred to colony collapse disorder, and I actually have some beekeepers coming on, I think it's in 2 weeks, right. And we're going to discuss beekeeping, and I'm sure that will be one of the issues right. That comes up. But as I was reading this article that you sent to me, beekeepers are losing 30% of their hives every year.
And some even higher. Some less, but that's been the problem. It's just very high colony loss and just, not economically viable. Beekeepers can't continue to stay in business if they're losing that many hives. Plus, the cost for them then to sell their pollination services, of course, goes up when you have big losses in your business. And so that gets too expensive, too, for the fruit growers and others that are paying, beekeepers to come and bring their hives in.
So is that why I'm paying $6.50 a pound for walnut?
Yeah, it could be part of it. Yeah. Well, walnuts aren't actually pollinator. They rely more on wind, but certainly almonds, that's a big factor with them. And certainly a lot of the berry crops, like blueberries, they rely heavily on bees, cherries, apples. So yes, that certainly adds a cost to it. Fuel costs, we've heard, have been a big part of crop cost increases too.
So what's happening? What's some of the new research showing? It seems like it's more of a number of things rather than just one.
It's a complex of things that's what the research is pointing to. And it's not too surprising that it's not just one thing. A lot of times, as human beings, we like it to be one simple solution that we can, tweak or fix, and then it'll all be better again. But it is quite complex. And the recent research is showing that it's a combination of factors. So we've known for a while that there are several kinds of mites that attack honeybees and their hive. And so those are certainly an issue, especially the varroa mite. But also there's some pathogens such as a fungus, a Nosema fungus that causes a foul brood, makes the brood die of fungal infection. There's also a virus called deformed wing virus that can affect the adults and make them not able to fly.
Is this related to the wasps? We see this virus
in the local populations of the European paper wasps where you see that deformed wing effect.
And would that be because honeybees aren't native to here? I mean, is that why it's affecting them like it does the wasps?
Well, certainly this virus seems to have a broad enough host range that it's attacking bees and wasps. So I don't know the spectrum of all the different species that are susceptible, but they are seeing this also in the honeybee colonies as well. And then another factor that's been pointed out for a while, especially in Europe, where they have felt that some of the systemic insecticides have been playing a role in causing not outright mortality, but what we call sublethal effects, where they cause reduced vigor, maybe some behavioral changes where they're not as efficient in foraging for nectar and pollen, or not as efficient at working in the hive. And so the quality of, life in the hive goes down, and of course numbers are going to go down. But then one of the most recent findings that I thought was particularly interesting in this article that I sent you is this new parasitic fly that was found. And I like the way they described it. They call it the zombie effect, because what it can do is cause, when a bee is infected with this parasitic fly, it causes the bee to, again, change behavior, and they actually abandon the hive for the good of the hive. So they realize that they're sick, and they don't want to spread that fly parasite to more individuals in the hive, so they'll actually just abandon the hive. And that's part of what they've seen in colony collapse disorder, is this just great abandonment of the hive. The workers don't come back. And so there's, the queen and all the brood inside, but there's just very few workers to serve that colony. And then, of course, it collapses over the winter in particular.
So it kind of discourages someone from me that wants to be just
a hobbyist.
Backyard hobbyist
from
wanting to do this, because I know the benefits that you can have from having a hive. But
certainly. And I'm sure that when you get these beekeepers on, those that are experienced with beekeeping can give you, you know, a lot of good tips about things you can do. But I mean, the bottom line is it's become harder to be a beekeeper. You have to be much more more careful. You have to be very strict with, monitoring your hives and treating them for some of these, like the mites. There are, products you can put on them to treat them, the fungus, keep foul brood out, things like that. You'll just have to be much more vigilant, so to speak, with your hives than you maybe in the past, where it was a little more, laid back. You didn't have to be so careful. And so I think it is going to be discouraging to some of the hobbyists who, who aren't doing this for a living and don't have that much time to put into it. So it may certainly decrease hobbyist beekeeping. But on the other hand, as there is this big concern for loss of pollinators, we might see it has had a resurgence of interest because of that. So hopefully we'll learn how to work with this. There's a lot of researchers doing work to see how we can improve the quality of hives. There's a bee researcher at University of Minnesota who's been looking at what they call hygienic behavior. So bees that groom regularly and do activities that help keep the parasite and the pathogen load low in the hive. And so those kinds of bees would have an advantage over less hygienic bees.
So this may be a very basic question. How many varieties of honeybees are there? I mean, I usually think of a European honeybee, but
yes.
Are there a lot of different?
There are. The very first honeybees that were brought to the United States to start honeybee colonies here were what they call the Italian strain. So a European honeybee, but they were collected originally in Italy. And there are, since then, there's been honeybees collected from all over the world. And you've heard of course, the Africanized honeybee, the killer bee. So that's a strain that comes from Africa. So there's many different kinds. And over time, bee researchers, beekeepers have been selecting for certain strains that they like the characteristics of better than others. Of course, the low aggressiveness, this hygienic behavior, and other things, strong genetic characteristics that make them good for management and honey production.
So how many years will that be before we have these grooming honeys of bees available?
Well, I think they're already available, and they are starting to show some benefits out there. It just is going to take time and they're not a silver bullet. They're not going to solve all the problems. And research, of course, is continuing with determining how best to manage these different multitude of problems. But the particular article that I sent you is about kind of a new extension effort called Bee Informed Partnership. And so this is trying to work with beekeepers, doing regular surveys to see, what's working well for them, what isn't working well. And as we learn, we see the examples of those beekeepers that are having success, trying to find out, what is it that's causing that success so that we can start to share those success stories and improve beekeeping around the country.
Now, the hard thing about this is if pesticides are causing the problems, I mean, you could have a hive and all your neighbors around you may not use pesticides, and you don't use pesticides, but they're still going to be exposed to it because they're flying all over the place.
There are, and there's been limitations already put in place with some of these systemic insecticides that they're not be used before bloom on crops. And I mentioned in particular they had a lot of problem in Europe, and I believe it was, some of the... I'm trying to remember which crop it was that they were growing where they were using these systemic insecticides on the crop while they were in bloom or before bloom. And so that was being really heavily expressed in the nectar and pollen of the flowers. And so we're changing pesticide label registration so that we're moving these systemic insecticides later into the season. That's one way we can help mitigate that. The one particular insecticide that has been pegged to be one of the most problematic, imidacloprid. Again, as I mentioned, labels are changing, so that's not used early season. The systemics, they bring lots of good advantages. We've talked about them here on the show before, where instead of having this broad spectrum toxicity where it kills everything that it contacts, you apply it to the foliage of the plant or to the roots where it's taken up by the plant, and it's expressed just in the tissues, and so you're focusing more on targeting those plant-feeding insects, which has great advantages for conserving, preserving the beneficial and non-target insects out there. But the problem has been this getting into the pollen and nectar, so there has to be ways to prevent that, and that's what more research is focusing on that.
So are there some new insecticides that have come out in just the last couple of years that will be a little more pinpointed and available for the homeowners? I know that commercially some might be more available.
Yes. So there is actually, as I was going to mention with some of the fruit insecticides, there's a relatively new one now available for the homeowner. It's been on the commercial market for a while. It's called acetamiprid. And the nice thing about it is it has a little longer activity, so a couple weeks, 14 days. Whereas, as you know, in the recent past, the suite of products has shrunk down to where they're mostly quite short activity products. But this acetamiprid is in the same class of insecticides as imidacloprid, the one I just mentioned that they've been particular problems. Imidacloprid is more mobile. It's the one that's been getting into the pollen and nectar. This has not been shown to be the issue with acetamiprid. It's more locally systemic, but doesn't move as far in the plant. And so its research so far has shown that this one is not causing problems with the honeybees. And it's only registered for use post-bloom on fruit trees, so you would not ever apply it before the trees were blooming.
Well, and for the homeowner, at least from my experience, those who have fruit trees in their backyard, there's not a whole lot you have to do for apples. The main pest
is coddling moth.
Right. A little bit of a problem with, was it mites?
Yeah, I was going to mention blister mites.
So if you do your
delayed dormant spray,
which for very northern Utah can still be done. So why don't we talk about that a little bit?
So the cooler parts of the state, those that aren't yet with fruit trees in bloom, like here in Cache Valley, we're certainly seeing apricots have been in bloom for a while. But depending on where you're located, in places like Richfield and Uinta Basin, where you're still cooler areas, if your apple, peach, and so forth are not yet in bloom or fully leafed out, you can still use a delayed dormant spray. And the nice thing about the delayed dormant spray is that you're putting on an horticultural oil, so very highly refined oil that's manufactured specifically to put on plants. And this is causing suffocation of insects and mites that overwinter on the tree. Now, this one will not help with coddling moth because coddling moth overwinters down on the trunks of the tree. But it was very good for the blister mites. And this was one that we saw a lot of last year, both in apple and pear. And these are little teeny tiny mites that overwinter in the buds of the fruit trees.
And what does it do to the leaf? How
so
do you know you got it?
It causes these, it looks like blisters. Initially, they're on the underside, you see these little puckers or whitish tissue areas. And then as the leaf matures, you see those blisters turn to brown. And so it's a brown little pucker spots on the bottoms of the leaves in particular. And again, some of the varieties of apple we were talking before the show, certain varieties tend to get this more than others. Gala, you mentioned, Jonathan, you saw it a lot.
The ones you like the best.
Yes, right. and then pear. It's a different species of mite, but they do the same thing on pear. So that delayed dormant oil, plus adding either carbaryl, which is 7 is the brand name. Or if you don't do that, you can just use a sulfur product. Don't mix oil and sulfur together. They are not compatible. You'll get burning of the foliage, but you can just use a sulfur. And you can even wait on the sulfur alone until you've got the new foliage out there, just starting to, the new leaves starting to come out.
So if I've seen on my gala that the bud itself has broken, but it's still pretty tight. And I can't tell if there are any blossoms in there or not.
that you can still do your delayed dormant spray.
So how long then? It can I still do it even if I see blossoms but they haven't popped open yet, or is that too late?
Once we get into what we call an apple pink stage, which is where you see that
actually see something.
That blossom, the pink flower, the outer part of the flower, then it's getting a little late. You can start getting burn from the oil on those flowers. So you want to do it before that point.
But as long as you don't see any color, then you're good to go?
That's right.
Okay.
And so we should mention what are these dormant oils good for, these delayed dormant sprays? So they're good for the blister mite we just talked about. They're really good on aphids. They suffocate the eggs of the aphids that overwinter on the limbs of the tree. And they're good on the peach twig borer. And this is one that we don't see so much as a problem in the cooler parts of the state, but certainly along the Wasatch Front. And I've had some people tell me even here in Cache Valley where they have some older peach trees that they start to see this this peach twig borer cropping up. And that overwinters up on the younger branches, you know, the newer wood. And so that's a good one you can get with the delayed dormant too.
Okay. Well, you're listening to Access Utah. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. She's in studio for the entire hour. And if you'd like to join our conversation, toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or go online to upr.org and click on the Programs tab, and you'll see Access Utah. We do have an email question from Valerie. She says, I live on the west side of Cache Valley and have noticed a large number of small moths in my perennial flowers, bushes, and around the yard. I'm not sure if it is a coddling moth. I wonder what damage they can do to summer vegetable gardens, not just fruit trees. What sprays can be applied or should be applied now?
In terms of moth activity now, generally it's not time to do anything. My guess is that these are some of kinds of moths that aren't going to necessarily be a problem in the landscape. We've got lots of different kinds of moths out there, and it's hard to know which ones she's seen in particular.
Which ones tend to come out this early?
You know, there's some that overwinter in wood piles and inside your house. I see them throughout the summer, and some of these are, you know, their caterpillars do feed on some of the shade trees around or box elder trees, but they're usually not something that's any kind of, you know, economically damaging problem, so we don't manage them. So I wouldn't worry about you know what you're seeing now. I would just keep an eye on things, and if you're starting to see any feeding damage, well then that would be time to take some action.
Well, let's talk about what moths tend to do cause problems. We talked about coddling moths. Mm-hmm.
That's very specific for apples and pears.
There are the big honking sphinx moths that lay their eggs in the tomatoes and like to eat your tomatoes.
Right, but you won't see those this early. Those are more of a summer
active.
Yeah, it's
going to be a little while later.
Yes.
And then there are the moths that you see flying in your lawn.
Right, so those are called the sod webworm, and those can be a problem in your lawn. But again, it's too early for those. They're not out yet.
So is it to basically just wait until you start seeing them flying around before you do anything for them?
Well, in general, we don't recommend with an integrated pest management approach that you treat like adult moths, because generally they themselves are not feeding on the, they eat nectar. You know, they're not chewing, feeding pest on your plants. And so they can indicate a problem to come or that they're out and active and laying eggs. But just if you see in general some moths around, you know, there's a corn earworm moth is another common one that we see in our vegetable gardens later in the summer. But again, it's way too early for them.
And if you're like me and plant your corn so late that you tend to not get any corn earworm.
Just avoid, you're too late. You escape damage. So so again, it's you know, just because you see some moths flying around your garden doesn't mean you should get out there and do any spraying. It's there's many different kinds that are out there. Many just pass through. They're not necessarily a problem for that particular plant. So you need to first identify. That's a key point of integrated pest management, is properly diagnose or identify what the problem is before you do any kind of treatment.
Well, let's talk about the IPM website through Utah State University, because there's a lot of great information that's available there. So it's pests.usu.edu?
It's actually Utah Pests.
Pests. Oh, sorry, I keep leaving that off.
Utah Pests, all one word,
.usu.edu. Okay.
Right, and that, that takes you to what we call our homepage. And on there, you'll see four different kind of squarish or rectangular-shaped item blocks in the middle. And so one will refer you to our diagnostic lab, the Utah Plant Pest Diagnostic Lab. One will refer you to the Integrated Pest Management website, which is where the pest advisories are housed that we've talked about a lot on this show. One takes you to a pest survey program, and one takes you to, what's the other one? Oh, bees. Yeah, we have some bee resources right there for you on our website. So those are the four main then websites or web pages housed within our master website. But then you also see over on the left, there's a navigation bar. You see things like fact sheets and frequently asked questions and image galleries and slideshows, video fact sheets. We've talked about those before on the show, where I've got some up there that show you how you can do some homemade traps for earwigs and paper wasps and things like that. We have our quarterly newsletter, and so that's on the left navigation bar. And so there's lots of ways to get into our information. Then you also see a little Google search window there. So if you're looking for something in particular, I wanted to mention that we have updated our Utah Home Orchard Pest Management Guide, so for 2012. And so if you were to type home orchard pest management or something to that effect in there, that would come up as a link and could help you with specific pests and different ways to manage those pests in your home orchard.
You know, I'm just looking at this moth going, okay, this is another moth, the cabbage loopworm.
Yeah, it's actually a butterfly. So moths and
butterflies,
yeah, they're closely related. They're in the same group, the Lepidoptera group. Yeah. So yesterday, just walking out in the marsh, it was such a lovely day, I saw a lot of cabbage butterflies. These are the white, we call them sulfur butterflies, but they're a whitish color with a little black spot on the wing.
I have a cat that tends to like to eat them, so yeah. I let her out in the garden as often as possible. So this is a really good website, and I highly recommend for people to sign up for
the pest advisories.
And
so if you were to go to the Integrated Pest Management link there.
Okay, so it shows an apple on it.
Right, shows an apple on it. It says Integrated Pest Management. So if you click on there, and then the next screen that's going to show up, it says subscribe to IPM Pest Advisories here. So if you click there, it'll take you to another page that shows you where you can enter your email address. And there's four different advisories to choose from: a landscape one, a small fruits and vegetables, the tree fruit one, the turf one, and then it also asks you if you're interested in receiving notices of when our newsletters come out. So
basically you get these, and then you click through the link that's in the email that you get. And then it takes you right to
the web page where they're posted.
And these are really nice because they not only tell you what the problems are, but there are pictures that show you these are the problems and what they look like.
Right.
And this is what to do.
Right.
And I've mentioned on this program in the past that I hardly ever have to spray for coddling moth anymore because I take a look at the advisory when it comes and it says, okay, this is when it's going to be a problem in your area. Even in Cache County, it'll give me Smithfield, I think Providence,
and Logan.
Mm-hmm. And I'm close enough to Smithfield that I use Smithfield's date. Mm-hmm. And if it says this is when they're flying, that's when I spray. So you can really pinpoint it right down and not have to spray very much.
Right. And actually what it's telling you with coddling moth is when the eggs are starting to hatch, because that's the stage that you need to enter. That's the point where you need to intervene to prevent the little larvae, the little caterpillars from getting into your fruits.
Because there's nothing worse than pruning your tree, thinning the apples out, and then having worms.
And then,
yeah. I know they provide protein, but it's not.
I don't like to share that. I'm okay to share some, but I don't like to share that much.
Well, and you can't store them because they rot.
No, they rot.
Because of that. So.
And they get a lot of molds and things in them that aren't particularly pleasant to even eat around. You have to cut out so much of it that it's not hardly worth it.
Unless it's a Honeycrisp, but then you want to get every last little bit
Then you're willing. But yeah, why not just do a few well-timed sprays and then not have to deal with that or deal with it very minimally.
Well, we've reached the halfway point of our program. You've been listening to Access Utah. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. And if you have any questions or comments, we'll take them at 800-826-1495. or at upr.org, and then clicking on the Programs tab for Access Utah. You'll hear now the latest edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll be back with the second half of the program, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
This is Linda Curvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society. Vast migratory swarms of flying grasshoppers or locusts have periodically scoured arid parts of Africa and the Middle East since biblical times, devastating crops and causing famine. But did you know that during the 19th century, American homesteaders were likewise plagued by migratory swarms of grasshoppers? The largest swarm passed through Nebraska in June of 1875. It was 110 miles wide, 1,800 miles long, and more than a quarter mile thick, taking 5 days to pass overhead. It remains the world's largest recorded insect outbreak. Here in Utah, at the time of the Transcontinental Railroad, migratory locusts periodically descended on the homesteads of Mormon settlers, laying up to 1 billion eggs per acre. These ravenous swarms devoured crops, vegetation, even laundry hung out to dry. Around the Great Salt Lake, drowned, pickled grasshoppers would wash ashore in vast drifts. Native peoples gathered these salty, sun-dried hoppers for food, a rich source of protein and fat. So why are we no longer plagued by locust swarms? It appears that the Rocky Mountain locust went extinct at the turn of the 20th century. Entomologist Jeffrey Lockwood reports that the DNA of specimens preserved in the ice of glaciers in the Wind River Range are like no other grasshopper alive today. The cause of the locust's abrupt extinction may never be known with certainty, but Lockwood believes that these outbreaks originated in the mountain meadows of the northern Rockies. By the 1880s, these public lands were packed with cattle and sheep, far more than the land could sustain. In a few short years, livestock stripped bare the very core habitats needed by the Rocky Mountain locust, leading to its abrupt extinction and the end of locust swarms in North America. This is Linda Curvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Welcome back to the second half of Access Utah. I hope you'll join us with your questions or comments. Diane Alston, extension entomologist at Utah State University, is my guest. Toll-free number is 800-826-1495, or go online to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and send us your email question. Okay, well, I was going to ask one of my questions. I was digging the rest of my carrots and my beets, and notice these clear little cysts. I don't know if you call them cysts or eggs, along the sides of both of those root crops. I figured they must be slugs because I did see a couple of slugs underneath my bags, but I wasn't too worried because I was digging everything and so they weren't going to have anything to eat. But is that what I was looking at?
You're
were slugs?
Exactly right. You okay. Diagnosed it just right. Yes. So slug eggs are about a quarter inch, maybe a little bit bigger. Typically clearish, but they'll get more opaque as they mature. So as the little slug inside is developing.
So these were pretty clear. So
they were
must have
probably
just been laid.
Fairly young.
Okay.
Yeah. And how quickly they hatch will depend on the temperature. They're always laid in very moist places in the soil. So
my removing the bags may have killed them. Or helped?
It may have helped, certainly. Okay. Yeah, certainly helped. But they'll hatch in within, you know, a couple weeks in the summertime to probably more like a month, might take almost a month at this time of year when our soil temperatures are still quite low. And then you have lots of little baby slugs down there feeding away. But you've pulled your carrots and beets, so of course you've removed their food source for them too. But slugs are a very interesting animal. They're, as you mentioned at the beginning, they're in the gastropod or mollusk group. And they feed in places that are damp, moist, lots of decaying organic matter, but they'll feed directly on the plant material as well. And so one of the main ways you can reduce slug populations is by changing the habitat a little. If it's in your shady plant bed like your hostas, it's a little harder because you need to keep that, and they will only grow where there's shade, so you can't really open up the canopy too much and let a lot of sun. It'll kill your hostas. And you do want to have some mulch and things to help conserve soil moisture, but you can still do some things to help reduce the amount of slugs. You can do a little bit of cultivation around in the soil around the plants, you know, not damaging the roots themselves, but just a little bit of cultivation with a little hand fork, a hoe fork kind of thing. We'll just break up that soil a little bit, make it a little less conducive to the slugs. But you can also do things like baits and traps. So one of the most common homemade traps is made with just very inexpensive beer, the cheapest beer you can buy. They're real attractive to that yeast.
Billy Beer.
Yeah, Billy Beer, is that really a brand?
It used to be, yeah. A long time ago.
My husband was reminding me of when he used to play on a softball team in North Carolina. The softball team always bought this kind of beer that just, it was such the cheapest beer, just said beer on the can. That's all it said, didn't have any brand on it. So something like that level of beer doesn't have to be expensive, but they're attracted to that, the yeast in the beer product, that fermentation that's going on. And you can just put out little containers, you know, little plastic containers with this beer in it, and they'll crawl in and they ingest, they imbibe it, and then it actually ends up killing them. They can't get out of the dish and they die.
So can you create your own? In other words, if it's the yeast,
right? You can make your own. You can make your own just with a bread yeast water solution as well. So that's, you can certainly do that. I think sometimes just buying that very cheapest beer is even cheaper. Yeah. Then bread yeast tends to be a little more expensive these days. There's also some commercial products. One of them least toxic to pets, people, and non-target things is made with iron phosphate. And one of the brands is Sluggo Bait, but there's many different brands. But iron phosphate, when they ingest it, it basically paralyzes their digestive systems, and they die that way. So that's another option. But out in your garden, if you're having problems like where you're going to be planting your vegetables this year, again, that cultivation, doing some things to dry that soil out a little bit before you plant into it.
So that's where tilling can be an advantage.
Right. You don't want to, you know, lose all your soil moisture, obviously. You're trying to preserve some of that. But just things you can do to open it up a little more and get a little more sunlight and breakdown of organic matter in that area will help. There are a lot of natural predators as well. Some of the ground beetles, of course, small amphibians and reptiles like small snakes, garter snakes, are very attracted to feeding on slugs. So certainly encouraging those other kinds of little critters in your garden, the good little critters, can help.
I know my aunt doesn't like to come over to my house because there are garter snakes all over the place.
Oh,
but
really?
I think maybe that's one of the reasons why I've never really seen much of an issue with the slugs, because I've got the snakes.
Yeah,
and usually,
garter snakes,
you know,
lizards.
Sometime the next couple of weeks I'll start seeing them popping up. And I think that's another indication of the health mm-hmm. of the garden. At least I hope it is.
It is.
I really like seeing them because I know they're eating lots of things.
Right. So I know a lot of people are afraid of snakes, but those small garter snakes or things like gopher snakes, those are all very beneficial. And it's good to encourage them to have them around. And they're not harmful to people at all. And they can bring a lot of good benefits.
So with the snails, how in the heck do they get eggs on my carrot halfway down the length of the carrot. It just seems like the soil would be too hard for them to get through. But
well, slugs spend a big part of their time in the soil. In fact, in the winter, that's where they hang out. They're not, as you know, up above ground walking across the snow. So they're in the soil, and they are very effective at tunneling in soil. And they'll lay their eggs on old, wet, moldy leaves, on your carrots or beets that are still in the ground, the roots of different kinds of plants and things like that. That's where they'll lay their eggs. I was mentioning to you before the show started that they have an interesting life cycle. They're actually hermaphrodites. So they'll each be a male and female throughout their life. They still do cross-fertilization. So they start off when they become an early adult, they first are a male. And then they'll look for females to mate with. And then later in life, they change and their female reproductive organs develop and they become a female. And then they'll be seeking out, younger adults, which are males, to mate with. And so that you use the term breeding like rabbits. So, yeah, the same kind of thing. They're able to produce a lot of offspring per individual. And because they go through this unusual life cycle, it helps them be very productive in their numbers.
So anyone with younger children are familiar with this question, why?
Why have they
developed this way? What do you think it is the advantage in nature for them that older females are mating with younger males?
Well, because it doesn't take as many individuals in a population to have a breeding population. So if you start off as a male and there's some other individuals that are out there that are female that you can mate with, and then later on you change to female and you can mate with those other males. So you can fulfill both parts of the provision of gametes for the population. So it just is a way to help populations that can be small.
And in Utah, they would be because
right.
There's not as much moisture around.
So you can move into habitats that are kind of borderline, for your requirements, such as a more arid state like Utah, and still, survive and still produce.
Well, I'm here to tell you, I'm very glad we don't have the huge foot-long snails. And I tell you, they are a foot long.
Yeah, the Northwest.
In the Northwest. Anyone who's been hiking in like coastal country or even in the Portland area, they're just, it's just hard to describe them because you go, ew.
They're so large. And when I first started working here with pest management and extension with Utah State University, and people would ask me about slugs. We don't see too many snail problems in Utah, a few, but not on the level that you see some places. And I was a little bit rude the first time. I almost laughed because I was like, slug problems here? I grew up in Southern California where snails were a huge problem, and they would just, every place after a little rain would just have all these slime trails from all the snails, and my mom's camellias would just be loaded with them. And so it's like, we don't know how easy we have it here with those mollusks.
Well, they were so bad in some places. When I lived in the Northwest, I started calling them the Oregon State Bird.
Yes.
They're just so pervasive.
But they have a lot more decaying organic matter.
That's
there,
true.
Which is, all part of what they need in their life cycle. So, yes, we were borderline here for slugs. But we can have problems with them, certainly.
Okay, well, what other issues should we be concerned about right now? We've talked about delayed dormant, slugs, honeybees.
Well, I did want to mention that last year we had a lot of aphids. Seemed like both 2010 and 2011 were big years for aphids. I don't know if you remember going way back to the fall of 2010, we had some huge flights of aphids.
Yeah.
And even made the local TV news programs.
I mean, they were in Salt Lake, but I didn't really see them here.
We didn't
but
really
then last
see them
year,
here.
I did see some.
Yeah,
of them
there
here,
were more so. Of them. So in the fall, saw these lots of these little tiny insects flying around, and a lot of those were aphids. So it's possible we could have another big year this year. We don't know for sure. We had a mild winter. That would suggest that their eggs, which are laid on woody hosts, primarily, that's one of the main ways they overwinter, would be, at least the pest ones, that they would be doing very well and survive the mild winter that we had. On the other hand, we may see that the populations start to go down because we did have two big years of them, or a year and a half of them. And so their predators and parasites and things maybe were building up last year, and this year their numbers might be down. So that's why we've talked about this before. It's so hard to predict you know, who's going to, which insects are going to be big and which ones are not in any particular year, because there's so many different environmental factors that at play, not just the weather, but there are some of the biotic things like their predators and so forth.
Now, one population that I have seen collapsed would be like the vole population.
Right.
I used to see,
yes.
I mean, I'd never seen them like I did the last couple of years. And then last year, I don't think I saw one in my garden. And my root crops didn't get touched.
Right.
So it's nice
much
to see those down.
Much better year for lower, less voles. In fact, we have a lot of great horned owls that roost and have been hanging out around where I live because of all the voles the last few years. And this winter, I heard them at night, but not nearly
much.
Like I did
yeah.
a winter ago where they were just every night, all night long, hooting around. And and I saw signs that they were helping out with eating the voles, which I was very happy for.
But one population I am just not seeing a collapse of in my garden, and it's been 5-6 years, grasshoppers.
You're still seeing them.
They're just still huge populations. And so maybe it's just they found something delicious in my garden, but it's really hard. So are you seeing lower populations?
They tend to be very spot, you know, the grasshopper populations are spotty. I mean, you know, some areas can get them really bad, and sometimes they can last for, in that area for a couple years before they decline, and then they'll, you know, kind of be bad in a different area. So they do tend to move around. I mean, certainly there's some places of the state, some counties of the state that have traditionally had more problems than others, and those tend to be a lot of our more western counties, so Box Elder, Juab, Miller, Tooele, some of that, you know, drier rangeland. And so here's one of the factors that's a big part of grasshopper populations is their egg beds. So this has to be undisturbed soil where the females last fall laid their eggs. And they lay their eggs down into the soil in what are called egg pods. So it's kind of like a little cluster of them all stacked up together.
And you've seen them. When I'm digging, it's orange.
Yes.
They kind of look like rice, about
right.
the size of a rice grain.
A little like a rice grain. They'll all be stacked together in this little egg pod. But they don't lay those in disturbed soil because they're not likely to survive in soil that's getting cultivated that's been disturbed. So they tend to lay them in, again, this kind of rangeland or here around urban areas. If you have an open lot or if you have a part of your lot that you don't cultivate, but it still has good conditions for them to lay their eggs in. So what does that mean? It means soil that's not too dry, but not super wet, that doesn't have too much vegetation at the top so that they can't, you know, get their eggs laid down in the soil. So if you have a very thick lawns, like for example, you're not going to get grasshopper eggs in that. But I noticed in one place where I live where we had a flagstone area, patio area, and we'd use some sand and other kind of soil to between the flagstones, and I would get grasshopper eggs in there. So those are the kinds of places where they breed or where they lay their eggs, and so that's where they're coming from.
So I'm probably not getting any from the pasture that's behind my property.
If it's got turf on it and, you know, and especially if you have any livestock at all
yeah.
that are wild, it's probably not a good grasshopper egg bed, no.
So I'm breeding them myself.
So what kind, yeah, do you have some sites where you've got undisturbed soil that's not vegetated, that's
well, I have my raspberry patch. And I cultivate between the rows, but I don't cultivate in the rows.
Right, which you really can't.
So, yeah. And then I've got two long rows of asparagus that I'm not going to dig up too much.
Maybe try putting some mulch down, just even some compost kind of mulch down this fall on the raspberry beds, the asparagus beds, and that might deter grasshoppers laying their eggs there.
Okay.
One suggestion.
That one.
But yeah, it's hard to predict. Hopefully you'll see a decline this year.
If any luck. I'm getting tired of going out at 10 o'clock at night and picking them off I go all over my whole yard. I'll spend a half an hour, and it's getting to the point where I'm tired of it, although I really like providing the dessert for my chickens. It's a lot.
Right.
It's a lot.
And you know, again, other factors at play, birds will eat them, and so if you can encourage you know, by feeding birds in your yard, those bring in those that are also insectivorous, that can help. I know you feed them to your chickens, so having, you know, livestock fowl can help. So any of those kinds of things, ducks.
But then chickens and ducks tend to eat your garden.
Right. You have to manage them. You have to manage them. You have to move them around and not let them stay so long they start causing harm to your garden.
Okay. So we have about 5 or 6 minutes left of the program. If you'd like to get in a question or comment, toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist, is my guest. Again, 800-826-1495, or go online to upr.org and click on the Programs tab to email your question to Access Utah. So in the next 5 minutes, what's the most important thing that someone could be doing right now to get rid of pests in the future? I know I was just thinking the other day, and I know it's too early for it, but I want to take care of my raspberries. Mm-hmm. This will probably be the first year that I've actually will be treating for the row stem girdler, for mm-hmm. instance.
Yeah, we had a lot of that last year.
I've been
here
having
Cache
a
Valley.
Lot of it, yeah. And yeah. I'm getting tired of seeing them. Those canes get nice, big, and beautiful, and then just break. Dry up, and they break off about right. knee high. So.
Right. So, so what are some of the most important things you can be doing now? If you've got some garden area that you're getting ready to plant, get out there and cultivate it. As we've talked several times this morning about how that can help reduce different kinds of pest problems. Purchase some row cover or plant fabric. This is a lightweight fabric. It comes in rolls, and you can use it to cover plants, but doesn't prevent sunlight from getting through, but it reduces problems with leaf miners,
flea beetles,
squash bugs. So get some purchase so you have it in your shed ready to go. In your raspberry bed in particular, if you've got some canes, as you're pruning off the tops, if your summer varieties, those that you're leaving that woody cane to grow the fruit this year, but you see a hole in the center of that cane, it very likely had a raspberry horntail, a different insect than the one you just mentioned. And I would just take my pruners and cut down a little bit, and if you keep seeing that hole go down and down, I would just ultimately take that whole cane out, because what you have is a raspberry horntail that's overwintered in that cane, and it's there, and the adult will be coming out of that and then laying more eggs in your raspberry bed. So good time to get rid of those overwintering pests.
We do have one question from Brett in Millville. Hi, Brett. How can we help?
Hi. I've just been listening to the last half of the program today. And my question is, my mom has just a really nice landscaped flower garden in her yard. But it seems like every year grasshoppers eat it to death. And she's the type of person that would love to use any kind of natural pest deterrents. As far as, like, I think she's tried soap and vinegar and things like that. And so I just had a question. Is there anything you would recommend that's kind of a natural pesticide that she could use to take care of grasshoppers aside from chickens? She thought about getting chickens, but she's not sure she wants to commit to that yet.
Okay, sure. Yeah, it's a very good question. And there's a product that contains a natural pathogen of the grasshopper. It's a protozoan, so a little spore-like pathogen, and it's called Nosema locusta, and the brand name of the baits that contain this are called things like Nolo bait. That's
Nolo?
One of the, yeah, no, N-O-L-O. That's one of the brand names. There are others, but they all contain this pathogen called Nosema locusta, and it's a natural pathogen of the grasshopper. And it's put into a product that has a bran base, so the bran is attractive for the grasshoppers to eat, and then they consume it, and they get this protozoan inside them, and it ultimately kills them. And it's really cool in that it causes the grasshoppers to climb up high on a stem, and they die, and then the spores shoot out of that dead grasshopper and land on the vegetation around it, and then more grasshoppers come along and eat the more spores. So it's self-propagating. It can infect more grasshoppers when one dies by putting out new spores. But the real trick to this is you've got to start early when the grasshoppers are young. And most people don't notice the problem until you've got the larger immatures, the ones that are close to being adults, and the adults all hopping around and flying around. But you've got to start early. And so this is generally going to be late June, early July. And you put out this bait as a protective border around your property, around the flower bed area. I suspect that there is some maybe open land nearby where the grasshopper eggs are developing and the grasshoppers are coming from.
Yeah, there definitely is. I heard that part of the conversation, and she does have about a fourth of an acre that's just an empty lot that she mows once in a while, but it's not. There's not a lot of grass, and it's definitely undisturbed.
So that's where they're coming from. Yeah. So put your bait. You know, that would be the area that you can put your bait out on that empty lot if that's possible. Put heavier borders on that side of the bait. You know, spreading it out as a band over there because that's where they're coming from, and you want to feed those young ones and kill them before they mature.
Migrate to her flower bed.
Right. So you got to start early and do it regularly because the bait does break down in irrigation or rainfall. So you know, just got to keep at it.
And then one other question, and that would be safe for animals. She just has a cat that roams the yard.
Yes, it's very specific just for grasshoppers. The other animals might eat the bran, but the protozoan's not going to cause them any harm.
Okay. So. Well, that was my question. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Brett.
Have a nice day.
You too. Take care. The one thing about this Nolo bait, I mean, that particular brand is not cheap.
It's not cheap.
And so, how do you know you're scattering it as needed?
Well, follow the recommendations on the label. They'll tell you like so much, you know, weight or cups or whatever per amount of area, and so just follow that. And you're right, it's not cheap. But if you want to go with something that's that's very non-toxic and very specific to the grasshopper, that is really the only option that's out there.
So late June, early July, I should be spreading this around in my raspberry patch or the areas where I know the soil is undisturbed.
Yes, that would be where the grasshoppers are coming from. You want to get them while they're young.
In the last minute and a half, I wanted to ask you about lady beetles.
Okay.
I seem to remember you telling me that what I'm seeing in the house is not necessarily the native lady beetles.
It's from Asia. It's called the Asian multicolored lady beetle.
But they do the same thing as, I mean, they're very beneficial.
They just
tend to be more in the house.
They were brought in from Asia with the purpose of helping to control aphids. That species feeds primarily on aphids that are on trees and shrubs. So it's an arboreal species. That's not going to be one that's down in your alfalfa or something like that. Like some of our native lady beetles do. But it is helpful for feeding on aphids that are problems in your linden tree or your apple tree. So they do provide some benefits, but they have this unfortunate side effect or side behavior of wanting to aggregate in warm places in the winter, and that's why you get them in your house.
Kind of like box elder bugs.
Yes. So they don't cause any harm other than the presence, and they do release, the orange liquid when you pick them up, and they can smell bad, but I mean they're not particularly harmful to you other than their nuisance effect.
And speaking of box elder bugs, they're going to start massing here fairly soon.
I saw them mating yesterday around my house.
And so we've got 45 seconds. Give me the recipe for spraying them with the soap solution to get rid of them.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't just one magic recipe.
Yeah.
It's just, a quarter teaspoon or so per gallon of water with a soap that's, I prefer to use one that's a non-perfume, non-colored one, so you don't get any staining or problems that way.
But this is a contact spray. You have to spray it right on them.
Right. So where they mass on the southwest parts of your house or fences or buildings, that's where you want to target them.
Diane, thank you very much for coming in.
It's always fun.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. We'll have her back next month, the second Monday of the month.
You can have a beautiful landscape and be kind to the environment by adopting the Earth Care Landscape philosophy. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Introduced by the Texas AgriLife Extension Service, EarthKind's goal is to help gardeners create easy care landscapes while preserving and conserving natural resources and the environment. These research-proven techniques combine the best of organic and traditional gardening and landscape practices. The process starts with selecting easy care plants suited to the growing conditions. This will yield beautiful results with minimal water, fertilizer, pesticides, and work for you. Proper placement will not only improve plant performance, but can also help reduce heating and cooling cost. And if you put the right size plant in the landscape, you'll need to do less pruning and have less waste to manage. Recycle fallen leaves and prunings into compost, wattle fences, and mulch. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.